Well, I'm glad to see each one of you here tonight. We have a really good number here, and I realize that we've got quite a few people that are visiting with us, and we want you to know that we are welcome and that you are welcome, and we are thankful that you have chose to stop and be with us here this evening to worship the Lord. And if you have an opportunity to come back at another time, we invite you to do that. We meet on Sunday mornings at 9 for Bible study, 10 for our regular worship service. Then, of course, at 6 and then 7 on Wednesday night. Tad Corder is our normal speaker, works with us here. And if you have an opportunity, I invite you to come back and to hear him. We are filling in today in his absence, and I'm thankful for Josh this morning. Josh Hester spoke to us, brought the lesson this morning. Alan Lesser, another member here, took over the class period, auditorium class period this morning. And I'm thankful, very thankful for their willingness to do this. I made a mistake in that it's been cold outside. I've been cold now for about 3 days, and for some reason I thought it would be good to get up here with a wool vest on and a jacket. And now that I'm here, I'm starting to question my decision to do that. I'm getting a little warm. All right, but that's not what we're here to do. We're here to look at the Lord's Word. So if you'll turn to Hebrews chapter 3, this is where we're going to begin our study tonight. I know that this is a holiday season, and maybe you've done some of the same things that I've done today, and that is you've eaten too much. You maybe been around family a lot. You know, if you'll bear with me here for the next few minutes, I'll try to do my best. You try to do your best. Okay, we'll work together on this. In Hebrews chapter 3. Notice what he says. He says, harden, verse 8, harden not your hearts as in the provocation in the day of temptation in the wilderness. When your fathers tempted me, proved me, saw my works 40 years, wherefore I was grieved with that generation and said, they do always err in their heart, and they have not known my ways. So I swear in my wrath, they shall not enter into my rest. So that's a strong admonition, isn't it? I mean, when he's talking to the books written to Hebrews here, we realize that these are Jewish Christians that he's writing to, and he's talking to them about their forefathers, and he's bringing a very strong word of instruction and direction here. And then he comes to verse 12, and he says, take heed, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God. And this is something that when maybe we look at it and we go, well, you know something, I'm a believer. Well, you know something, the people that he's talking to here are believers. And we may think that, but I'm a believer this is not something, I'm not in any jeopardy in departing from God. But I think it would be good for us to take the time tonight, it was good for me, to look at the children of Israel that he's talking about here in Hebrews chapter 3, and let's see what unbelief looks like. Let's see how it manifests itself with those people, and see if we can learn anything from it. So let's turn back, if you will, to Genesis chapter 46, and we're going to find Israel coming in to Egypt. And we realize, I'm not going to plow a whole lot of new ground here trying to get us up to speed, but we know the promise that God had made to Abraham and how it is that that he made the seed promise and the nation promise and the land promise. And he had said that they were going to be a great nation, and we realize that Jacob becomes Israel. God changes his name in making these promises. And when we get to Genesis chapter 46 and beginning in verse 3, it says, and he said, I am God, the God of thy father, Fear not to go down into Egypt, for I will there make of thee a great nation. And I will go down with thee into Egypt, and I will also surely bring thee up again, and Joseph shall put his hand upon thine eyes. And when God says this to Jacob, the thing that he's saying to him, this is when Joseph has already been down into Egypt. His brothers have gone down there because of the famine. Remember, there's not anything to eat in Canaan where they are. And so he sent back word for his whole family to come down. He's revealed himself to them. And so God appears here and tells Jacob, he says, you go down into Egypt. And he says, there I'm going to make of you a great nation. And it's kind of, when you look at the way that God did this, it's a wonderful thing, really and truly. Look, if you will, in the 33rd verse of that same chapter, Genesis chapter 46, verse 33. And this is where Joseph, he is describing to his brothers and to his family how that their relationship is going to be with the Egyptians and how they need to present themselves to Pharaoh and to the other Egyptians. And in verse 33 it says, and it shall come to pass when Pharaoh shall call you and shall say, what is your occupation? That you shall say, thy servant's trade hath been about cattle from our youth even until now, both we and also our fathers, that you may dwell in the land of Goshen, for every shepherd is an abomination unto the Egyptians. Now, you know something, that can be overlooked really easily, but really what takes place here is, one, they're going to be put into a good piece of land because of the cattle. All right, so the place wherein the thing that they are needing most at the time because of the famine is, and they're going to be placed there. And another thing that's going to happen is when they present themselves as shepherds, he says that all of the Egyptians look at a shepherd as being an abomination. You know something? We don't really mingle with them. And so what better way to make this great nation than to put it within another nation that really doesn't want to mingle with you. They want you to be there. They're glad that you're there. They see you as being a useful part of their society. And God takes 70 people and makes of them this great nation. And the description that it gives of how the relationship is between Joseph and Pharaoh and his family when they first arrive, we find here in Genesis 47 and verse 5. And Pharaoh spoke unto Joseph, saying, thy father and thy brethren are come unto thee. The land of Egypt is before thee. In the best of the land make thy father and brethren to dwell. In the land of Goshen let them dwell. And if thou knowest any men of activity among them, then make them rulers over my cattle. And so he's putting Joseph and his family in a position to wherein that they are separate in one way. But then in another way, they are very much desired. They're very much trusted. They're very much put into a place to where that they can excel. But then what happens? Turn, if you would, to Exodus chapter 1. And as long as Joseph lives in that generation, it seems as though that relationship was really good. But what happens after the death of Joseph? Exodus chapter 1 and beginning in verse 6. And Joseph died, and all his brethren, and all that generation. And the children of Israel were fruitful, and increased abundantly, and multiplied, and waxed exceeding mighty, and the land was filled with them. Now there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. And he said unto his people, behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come on. Let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply, and it come to pass that when they falleth out of any war, they join also unto our enemies and fight against us, and so get them up out of the land. Therefore they did set over them taskmasters to afflict them with burdens, and they built for Pharaoh treasure cities, Pithom and Ramesses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew, and they were grieved because of the children of Israel. Notice when you get down, let's continue on. Let's continue on through verse 16. And the Egyptians made the children of Israel to serve with rigor, and they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in mortar and in brick and in all manner of service in the field. All their service wherein they made them serve was with rigor. And the king of Egypt spake to the Hebrew midwives, of which the name of the one was Shephara and the name of the other Puah. And he said, when you do the office of a midwife to the Hebrew women and see them upon the stools, if it be a son, then you shall kill him. Now, I want you to think about the situation. They went from a place to where that they were selective and approved, and people seemed to be thankful that they were there in the land of Egypt. And now there's a new king, and it is a new generation. And when they begin to look upon Israel, they are now despised and distrusted, and they are used. You ever had maybe when you were growing up and you were a child and you were playing with other kids and all this kind of stuff, and you'd have them kids and they really didn't maybe want to play with you, but you had some toys they really liked. And so they would maybe want you to come over so that they could play with the things that you had. Or maybe they wanted to come to your house and play with things you have, but they really didn't want to associate with you. If you got away from the things that you had that they wanted, they really didn't want to have that much to do with you. And then that's when your mother or your dad would pull you aside and say, they're using you. You don't know what that feels like. Well, the children of Israel were used by the Egyptians to a point to where they were only seen as a commodity. A commodity is that thing which is common, that thing which is we have in abundance, that thing which is dispensable, that thing which can be discarded and replaced. That's the way that they looked upon the children of Israel at this time. To where that, you know something, we don't just have them here, but we want their life to be rigorous, and we want it to be difficult, and we want it to be a hardship for them to live among us. That's the way the Egyptians now begin to look at the children of Israel. And to a point to where that we are afraid of them. And we do not want their young men to grow up and excel and become mighty. We don't want there to be a mighty nation among us that's called the children of Israel. No. They are despised. What happens? Well, we know the story, how it is that God looks upon the children of Israel, hears their cry, what is taking place with them. We understand how it is that he sends Moses. You know, when Moses is there, the children of Israel, they can just be smitten, can be beaten in public. It can be that thing which is open. You know, even maybe when we begin to think about the account of what Pharaoh had said he wanted done to the young Hebrew baby boys that were born, how that he wanted them put to death. We may look at that and go, well, you know something, that may have been a decree, but surely, you know, that really wasn't followed that closely. But when we look in Exodus chapter 2 and beginning in the first verse, we get this account. And there went a man of the house of Levi, took to wife daughter of Levi, and the woman conceived, bare a son, and when she saw him that he was a goodly child, she hid him 3 months, and when she could not longer hide him, she took him for an ark of bulrushes, daubed it with slime and with pitch, and put the child therein, and she laid it in the flags by the riverbanks. Why was she hiding Moses? Because he could be put to death. Why is it that he could be put to death? Because whenever it is that the in Exodus chapter 1, whenever it was that the midwives wouldn't go in and kill the little boys, and the Pharaoh asked him, said, why are you not killing the boys like I instructed you to do? He said, because the Hebrew women have their children really fast, and by the time we get there, the child's already born. You know what he told his own people? He said, look in Exodus chapter 1, verse 22, and Pharaoh charged all his people, saying, every son that is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive. If you saw a Hebrew child that was male, the Egyptian could just go up and just grab it and throw it into the river. That's the life that they're living now, that the Israelites are living in Egypt. In Exodus chapter 5, when Moses comes back and he's met with God in Midian, and he comes back to tell Pharaoh, God wants these people to go into the wilderness and be able to worship him. What does Pharaoh do? Exodus chapter 5 and beginning in verse 6, and Pharaoh commanded the same day the taskmasters of the people and their officers, saying, you shall no more give the people straw to make brick as heretofore. Let them go and gather straw for themselves, and the tail of the bricks which they did make heretofore you shall lay up on them. We're running out of time, so we're not going to continue to read about all of those things. But their lives is just getting by the day. No matter what they seem to do, the more that they cry out unto the Lord, and the Lord comes and sends Moses and Aaron to speak on their behalf, only makes matters worse. They're slaves. They're despised. Their lives are not counted as being worth anything to the Egyptians anymore. If you can't do service for us, that's all that they care about. So what does God do? What do the children of Israel see that God does? Well, the very final thing after he has the plagues within Egypt and the Pharaoh continuously hardens his heart, we realize that there comes the time of the Passover. It comes a time to wherein that the angel of the Lord is going to come into Egypt and he's going to kill the firstborn in every house. And I think that we can overlook that sometimes. Because, you know, sometimes when we begin to think about calamities, we think about that there is this idea of working the percentages, right? You know, when we have a tornado, sometimes we get afraid because there's a tornado. But do we really, you know, we think the chances of it really hitting us and tearing up everything that we have is not that great. It's going to do some people, but because of the percentages, it won't be that great. Maybe we're going to fly somewhere. And we've heard of the planes going down and nobody being able to survive the plane crash. And yet, millions of people this weekend will get on a plane and fly all over the country. And why do they do that? Because, you know, we in our mind we think, because that's not going to happen to us. But I want you to think about the percentages when we're talking about what God did to Egypt. When he decided, I'm going to break Pharaoh, he's going to let my people go. In Exodus, the 12th chapter, and in the 30th verse, it says, and Pharaoh rose up in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where there was not one dead. There was not a house where there was not one dead. Can you imagine? Can you imagine in one night that being the case, to where that if we were to come and assemble here and every one of us would have had one dead, our firstborn? God showed that Pharaoh is nothing. He may have but tried to extend power over you, Israel, but he has no power over the God of heaven. God can deliver with a mighty hand. In Exodus chapter 14, when we begin to see God has brought Israel out of Egypt, Pharaoh has come to a place now to where that he's angry about the fact that they have left, and he decides to pursue them, and we realize that they come to the Red Sea, and that when the people look, and they are sore afraid of the Egyptians, the Hebrews are. They're terrified of the Egyptians. And in Hebrews chapter 14, in the beginning of verse 12, and when Pharaoh drew nigh, the children of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them, and they were sore afraid, and the children of Israel cried out unto the Lord, and they said unto Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, hast thou taken us away to die in the wilderness? Wherefore hast thou dealt thus with us to carry us forth out of Egypt? What's wrong? Is it because there weren't enough graves? You see how terrified that they are of the Egyptians who are pursuing after them. That's the life that they had lived. In terror. So God brings them into the wilderness. 2 months into the wilderness, we are in Exodus chapter 16. And they took their journey from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came into the wilderness of Sin, because it is between Elim and Sinai. On the 15th day of the second month after the departing out of the land of Egypt, and the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the children of Israel said unto them, would to God we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots, and when we did eat bread to the full, for you have brought us forth into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. Let me ask you, when we're over there in Hebrews chapter 3, when he makes this statement, take heed, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God. What does unbelief look like? I'll tell you what it looks like right here. Unbelief looks like complaining. Looks like complaining. It looks like they looked at their condition and they said, you know something, I wish that you had done something different, Lord. I wish you'd just left us back there. I wish you'd just killed us in Egypt when we were fat, full, and happy. They'd forgotten all about what their living conditions had been. Unbelief looks a lot like complaining. Perhaps you might be one of those individuals who says, well, you know something, I'm a believer. I'm not departing from God. Are you a complainer? Because unbelief here sounds a lot like complaining. Exodus chapter 17. Beginning in verse 1. And all the congregation of the children of Israel journeyed from wilderness of Sin after their journeys according to the commandment of the Lord, pitched in Rephidim, and there was no water for the people to drink. Wherefore the people did chide with Moses and said, give us water that we may drink. And Moses said unto them, why chide you with me? Wherefore do you tempt the Lord? And the people thirsted there for water, and the people murmured against Moses and said, wherefore is this that thou hast brought us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our cattle with thirst? What else do you notice there about what the children of Israel's doing? Unbelief looks a lot, sounds a lot like complaining. And I want to tell you what it looks a lot like. It looks a lot like somebody who is looking back on their past life saying, I wish I could go back. That's what disbelief looks a lot like. In Hebrews chapter 11, when he talks about the great chapter of faith that we read about in Hebrews chapter 11. And he goes through all of these individuals who overcome so many trials and tribulations in life because of their faith. Notice what he says in verse 13. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off and were persuaded of them and embraced them and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For they that say such things declare plainly that they seek a country. And truly, if they had been mindful of that country from which they came out, they might have had opportunity to have returned. But now they desire a better country, that is, an heavenly, wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city. The individual who looks upon his past life and says, that's where I desire to be. Disbelief looks a lot like looking back. In Luke chapter 9, Jesus says this about the individual who looks back on their past life. He's calling individuals to be his disciples in verse 61. And it says, and another also said, Lord, I will follow thee, but let me first go bid them farewell which are at home at my house. And Jesus said unto him, no man, having put his hand to the plow and looking back, is fit for the kingdom of God. Disbelief sounds a lot like complaining. Disbelief looks a lot like looking back. Let's go back to the children of Israel. Let's go to Numbers chapter 1. We're still on the journey. We're still going to the promised land. These same people that's come up out of the land of Egypt are still on a journey to the promised land. Numbers chapter 1, verse 1. Perhaps somebody else can give me a better timeline. This is the best one that I could come up with. And the Lord spake unto Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, in the tabernacle of the congregation, on the first day of the second month, in the second year after they were come out of the land of Egypt. Best that I can figure, we're talking about 14 months. The second month of the second year. I'm going to call that 14 months. Somebody might can show me that means something different. The reason why I want to bring that up is this. You remember 14 months ago? You can't you? We can remember all kinds of events that took place 14 months ago. We're in 22. Do you remember what happened in 2020? We can't we? We can remember all about a great pandemic and about how that our schools changed and our jobs changed, relationships with our families changed, how we go to the doctor changed, everything changed. Well, do you think that these individuals, 14 months, would have been able to look back and go, I can remember what my life was like 14 months ago when I was in Egypt? You think that they can remember that God had fed them with manna when they thought that they wouldn't have anything to eat in the wilderness within that 14 months? You think that they can remember that God had watered them from a rock during that travel in the 14 months? You think that they would be able to remember that God had divided the Red Sea and they'd walked through on dry ground and those Egyptians that they were terrified of, they had seen no more? You think that they would be able to remember all of these things? They would, right? They would be able to see what God has done for them. Look, if you will, in Numbers chapter 11. I want to go back now. I'm going to go back here to Hebrews chapter 3. Take heed, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God. Let's have that in the forefront of our mind. We're in Numbers now, chapter 11, beginning in verse 4. And the mixed multitude that was among them fell a-lusting. And the children of Israel also wept again and said, who shall give us flesh to eat? We remember the fish which we did eat in Egypt freely, the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic. But now our soul is dried away. There is nothing at all besides this manna before our eyes. Yeah, the complaining has started again, hasn't it? Notice what he says in verse 1 of Numbers chapter 11. And when the people complained, it displeased the Lord, and the Lord heard it, and his anger was kindled. This disbelief that sounds a lot like complaining, you're not complaining to your spouse. You're not complaining to your mother. You're not complaining to your father. You're complaining to the Lord. And the Lord hears it. When we think about our lives, God delivers Israel out of the bondage of Egypt. Sound familiar? We're a purchased possession. We've been delivered from the bondage of sin. God has done that for us. When we complain about our lives, the hope that is set before us, where God is leading us to eternal life, when we complain about that life that we have here, that God is providing for us, is it my husband or my wife hearing my complaining? Is that who I'm complaining to? Or is it as these people? The Lord heard, and his anger was kindled. Numbers chapter 14. We realize that the people have sent in spies. There's the spies that have been sent in have come from every tribe. They're all adults. They are people who are chief among their rulers among their tribes. So they're people that are well respected. And they go into the land and they spy it out. And we realize how it is that they come back and they say, we cannot take the land. They're right there on the cusp of what God had promised. After seeing all that he's done, and they said, we cannot take the land. Notice Numbers chapter 14, beginning in verse 1. And all the congregation lifted up their voice and cried, and the people wept that night. And all the children of Israel murmured against Moses and against Aaron. And the whole congregation said unto them, would God that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would God we had died in this wilderness. You hear the complaining? And wherefore hath the Lord brought us into this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and our children should be a prey? For it not better for us to return into Egypt? You see the looking back? But you notice something else that they said in there? For wherefore hath the Lord brought us into this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and our children should be a prey? I want to tell you something. Disbelief looks a lot like fear. You ever been afraid as a Christian? Been one of the situations where that it's time for me to speak, I'm afraid. Time for me to do, I don't know what the results are going to be. I'm afraid. Time for me to move forward. I'm afraid. I'm here to tell you, there's a time in our lives where fear is understood. You know, when you're a child comes in there, they're afraid of the dark. We understand that. But we also understand they need to face that. They need to overcome that. That this is just a stage of life. But when we get to a place to where they're an adult and now they're afraid of the dark, that's a problem. See, then that becomes something that hinders and halts us in our development and our being able to go forward and to do and to accomplish things. And there's a time wherein that fear is one of those things maybe that's healthy unto us, but then there's another time to wherein that fear is that thing wherein that the Lord looks at and He is sorely displeased with. And really what it manifests is a disbelief in the Lord who has made the promises. Notice what he goes on and says. And they said to one another, "Let us make a captain. Let us return into Egypt." Then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces before all the assembly of the congregation of the children of Israel. And Joshua the son of Nun, Caleb the son of Jephthah, which were of them that searched the land, rent their clothes. And they spake unto all the company of the children of Israel, saying, "The land which we passed through to search it is an exceeding good land. If the Lord delight in us, then he will bring us into this land and give it us, a land which floweth with milk and honey. Only rebel not ye against the Lord, neither fear ye the people of the land, for they are bread for us. Their defense is departed from them, and the Lord is with us. Fear them not." But all the congregation bade stone them with stones. Do not fear. Fear looks a lot like unbelief. I want us to look at just a couple of passages that's accompanied with fear. I'm afraid that fear is an excuse of the wicked. Matthew chapter 25. We know the parable of the talents that are given. Matthew chapter 25, beginning in verse 24. I got to get to the right passage here. We're down to the one talent man. Remember how it is that he's ready to give back the one talent that the Lord has given unto him? Notice what his response is, verse 24. "Then he which had received the one talent came and said, 'Lord, I knew thee, that thou art a hard man, reaping where thou hast not sown, gathering where thou hast not strawed. And I was afraid, and went and hid thy talent in the earth. Lo, there thou hast that is thine.' His Lord answered and said unto him, 'Thou wicked and slothful servant, thou knewest that I reap where I sowed not, and gathered where I have not strawed. Thou oughtest therefore to have put my money to the exchangers, and then at my coming I should have received mine own with usury. Take therefore the talent from him, give it unto him that which hath 10 talents, for unto every one that hath shall be given, and he shall have abundance. But from him that hath not shall be taken away even that which he hath. And cast ye the unprofitable servant into outer darkness. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth.'" This idea that being afraid is a good reason for not doing the work that the Lord has given you to do bears no weight. Matthew chapter 10. Again, Jesus speaking, talking about the fact that so many times we fear what man will do to us. We fear about the fact that someone is going to say something. Somebody's going to do something wherein that it's going to be uncomfortable for me. It's going to be displeasing to me. I'm going to look bad in their eyesight. But notice what Jesus says in Matthew chapter 10 and verse 28. And fear not them which kill the body and are not able to kill the soul, but rather fear him which is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. You want to talk about what fear is? He said, don't fear somebody that if all he can do to you is kill your physical body. You know, we may look at that and go, wait a minute. Now we're talking about somebody taking my life. He said, don't be afraid of that person. No, fear the one who can destroy body and soul in hell. That's the one that you fear. Revelations chapter 21, he talks about the lake of fire. He talks about an eternal destruction, talking about hell itself and what it is that it is reserved for. And notice what he says, verse 8. But the fearful and unbelieving and the abominable and murderers and whoremongers and sorcerers and idolaters and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burneth with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. This disbelief that separates us from God, it sounds a lot like complaining. It looks a lot like looking back. It looks a lot like fear. Let's go back to Hebrews chapter 3. This is the last passage. The lesson's going to be yours. Hebrews chapter 3. Harden not your hearts as in the provocation in the day of temptation in the wilderness. When your fathers tempted me, proved me, saw my works 40 years, wherefore I was grieved with that generation and said, they do always err in their heart and they have not known my ways. So I swear in my wrath, they shall not enter into my rest. Take heed, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief and departing from the living God. But exhort one another daily, while it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. For we are made partakers of Christ if we hold the beginning of our confidence steadfast unto the end. While it is said today, if you will hear his voice, harden not your hearts as in the provocation. For some, when they had heard, did provoke, howbeit not all that came out of Egypt by Moses, but with whom was he grieved 40 years? Was it not with them that had sinned, whose carcasses fell in the wilderness? And to whom swear he that they shall not enter into his rest, but to them that believed not? So we see they could not enter in because of unbelief. Unbelief manifests itself so many times in our lives in different ways. We can't allow that to overcome us. We have to continue, as he says, steadfast. Go ahead and get your song books out. I thank you for your attention tonight. I hope the lesson can be beneficial to you. I realize that there's times wherein that we have, in our spiritual lives, maybe we have some ebb and flow. Times where we are afraid, and we have to overcome that. Times wherein that we find ourselves being complainers. Maybe times when we're looking back going, you know, my life used to be easier for me than what it is right now. But that's not a life that we can continue in. That can't be a part of our life that goes on. We have to be the individuals to where that we overcome those struggles, even if somebody, if the perception that the world has of us is different, but we know within our own mind that we're working on these things, we have to continue to fight those things so that disbelief doesn't enter into our lives and cause us to be separated the way that it did for the Israelite. Perhaps you're here tonight and you have never obeyed the gospel. This is a perfect time and opportunity for you to obey the gospel, to be baptized into Jesus Christ for the forgiveness of your sins. Or maybe you're here tonight as a Christian. Maybe you have obeyed the gospel. Maybe you've been living your life as a Christian, but when you examine yourself, you realize that maybe I need some help. You know something? We all do. We all need the Lord to help us, to strengthen us, to encourage us, to forgive us, to give us things that we need. We need wisdom and we need understanding. And thanks be to God, He has placed within our lives Christians who maybe are struggling with the same things that you are. And all of us have struggled. And we would be happy to help you, to where in that we can help each other as we strive to do God's will. If we can in any way help you this evening, we bid you come as together.